Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking with Philip Gurevich. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. And we'll be talking about a story that he wrote about for the magazine, which he has now turned into an expanded version and has been published as a book. It's a story of how an investigator for the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, a man who had been a police officer in New York, solved a 27-year-old murder case. The title of the book is A Cold Case. It's published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. It's just come out recently. Philip Gurevich, in addition to writing for The New Yorker, is a contributing editor to The Forward. In 1998, he published his first book, a book about the Rwandan genocide that was titled We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families. It was a very powerful book. It won the National Book Critics Circle Award, the LA Times Book Prize, the George Polk Award for Foreign Reporting. He has also reported from Africa, Asia, and Europe for a number of magazines, including Granta, Harper's, and the New York Review of Books. And he's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk with Philip Gurevich, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Mr. Gurevich, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, it's great to talk to you.
The story starts out with an account of this murder that took place in 1970. The killer was a man named Frank Kohler.
That's correct.
The story was basically he got into an argument with two other men. There was a fight, and later that night, Kohler shot and killed these other two.
That's right.
You want to maybe flesh out that story of the murder a little bit for us?
Well, Frankie Kohler was essentially a career hoodlum, a man who referred to himself as a professional criminal. He'd grown up in the 40s and 50s in the west side of Manhattan, in Hell's Kitchen area, Chelsea, along the docks of the west side, which were largely controlled then by the Irish and Italian mobs. He had, from a very early age, been running the streets on his own as a lawbreaker, a burglar. He went to enlist in the army in World War II, lying about his age and pretending to be 15, but then lost some money in a crap game and went AWOL and got arrested for burglary almost immediately in New York. He then went on an armed robbery spree at a young age, got himself into more trouble. He'd committed his first murder at the age of 16. He'd spent really half of his life in jail and was working really as kind of a strong-arm man and enforcer with various mob racketeers in Manhattan. And he went on the night of February 18, 1970, to this bar, Channel 7, in the West 50s, which was a rather upscale, he favored kind of tasteful places. He liked to go to the Copacabana and Tootsie Stores to see the fancier acts, nightclub acts. He was a big Frank Sinatra fan, and he went to this place, Channel 7, which was very popular with TV and radio broadcasters. He went in for a drink, and there he met up with the owner of the place, Peter McGinn, a man whom he knew only slightly, and another man named Richie Glennon, who was the owner, Pete McGinn's close friend, and with whom Kohler had had some dealings. Glennon, although he also owned a restaurant, was also a bit of more of an underworld character himself. He had he was known as a loan shark, and he was into various things. And these two men, Kohler had been carrying on a rather public affair with the wife of a man who was in jail, who was a mutual friend of all three of theirs. And these two men, Pete McGinn and Richie Glennon, reproached him for this, saying this was obviously horrendous conduct. What kind of a person would actually take advantage of a friend being in jail to have an affair with his wife? And words were exchanged. It got heated up. Kohler basically picked a fight then with Pete McGinn, said, let's take it outside. They went outside, and Kohler's a small man and not much of a fist fighter, really. And Pete McGinn beat him up. And it was later, Pete McGinn went home to his apartment about a block away, Kohler went about his business and came back about an hour later to the bar, found Richie Glennon there, said, you know, let's all go up to Pete McGinn's place and talk about this. Let's put this behind us. Let's not let any hard feelings remain. Let's talk about this like gentlemen. They went up to the apartment, and within 5 minutes, there were shots heard from the apartment. Kohler ran out. These two men, Pete McGinn and Richie Glennon, were dead on the floor of the apartment. And Kohler fled into the night and disappeared for 27 years.
Yeah. And the police here, clearly it was, the case was, they knew perfectly well that Kohler had done it. They had a couple of witnesses. That wasn't the issue. The issue was that he simply dropped out of sight.
Exactly. I mean, this was one of the most un-whodunit stories you could ask for. There were witnesses to the argument in the bar. There were witnesses to the fight outside the bar. There were witnesses to Kohler's coming to the apartment. There was an uncle in the apartment at the time of Pete McGinn's who actually got a bullet in the hip during the shooting, but who obviously had seen the whole thing unfold. He was just wounded and all right. There were a number of witnesses. Richie Glennon's girlfriend had come into the apartment as Kohler ran out. She'd seen the bodies with him standing over them. It was never that. But what happened was he went. The police arrived on the scene moments later. Detectives immediately went looking for Kohler, but Kohler had fled. And he was a very successful fugitive. He managed to avoid any contact with any of the people, like his family members, that would have in any way allowed the police to track him. And he really genuinely disappeared. And this was, remember, in 1970, the murder rate in New York was about 2.5 times what it is today. The police were organized very differently without specialization of homicide units and so forth. There were none of the same attitudes towards tracking cases and preventing them from going cold when the trail went cold. And so if you didn't get somebody, the detectives, basically, if they didn't find somebody in a few months, it became a back burner case. Hmm. And that's what happened.
So now then we flash forward to 1997, and you introduce us to Andy Rosenzweig, who had been a New York City police officer. At the time, he was an investigator for the Manhattan DA. And this time, I think he was close to retiring. What was it that made him now think about this case and decide to take it up close to his retirement and 27 years after these murders?
Andy Rosenzweig had grown up a little bit younger man than Frankie Kohler, but he'd grown up in the Bronx and Bronx Park East, and he had, as a young man, he'd known Richie Glennon, one of the victims of this double homicide. He had worked at a swimming pool in Inwood in northern Manhattan as a lifeguard where Richie Glennon used to hang out. Richie Glennon had been a boxer at the time and a colorful character and somebody who ran with the crowd that Rosenzweig got to know, mostly themselves cops. This was before he ever became a cop. And when Rosenzweig himself became a cop, he and Glennon had a lot less to do with each other because Glennon was often on the other side of the law and they sort of kept their distance. And Rosenzweig was really one of the straightest arrows the department had ever seen at that point, it sounds like. And he, in January of 1997, he was never involved in the case. It was just that when he was a young man, a young cop, Richie Glennon's murder took place, and it was the first person that he'd known socially to get killed. He'd known cops on the job to get killed, and it sent a ripple through his crowd, and people were always talking about it like this case somebody was going to solve. Everybody knew who did it. And suddenly, 27 years later, he's driving uptown, of all things, to a stress test at New York Hospital, and he passes the street corner where Richie Glennon's restaurant, the Flower Pot, had once been, and he has this jolt of memory of the name Frankie Kohler and of the thought, I wonder if they ever caught that guy. And he thinks, you know, in my world, if they'd caught him, I would have heard. I can't, and the fact that I haven't heard means I must not have heard. It must not have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as he was done with his stress test that day, he started making phone calls, and it just really irked him to think that Frankie Kohler might be out there at large and having got away with murder. And he started collecting the case files. And in his capacity as the chief of investigations at the district attorney's office, now a pretty important top investigator in New York, he decided that on his own, he called it a lunch break case, he was going to start digging and figuring this one out.
I should here at this point introduce again our guest for this part of Focus. For anyone who might have just tuned in, we're talking with Philip Gurevich. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. And we're talking about the story that he tells in his recently published book, A Cold Case. an expanded version of a story that he wrote for the magazine. I should add that there is more material in the book than was in the magazine article.
Published a little bit more than twice as much.
So even if people have read the article, and I did when it was in the magazine, I thought it was a great story. There is more here that might interest you, and certainly for people who like true crime, it's a great story, published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. It's out in bookstores now. What happened was when Andy Rosenzweig started kind of checking around, trying to find out what anybody knew about this murder. Initially, he was told that the case was closed because Frank Kohler was dead.
That was the incredible thing, David. He went and dug up the files, and the first page in these old case files was from 1992, and it said, case closed with exceptional clearance. This is a technical term which can only be applied to a murder case when the suspect is dead. And for a suspect to be dead, you're supposed to be able to show an obituary, a death certificate, some evidence of the fact that their fingerprints from a corpse, something that says this guy's dead. So he read on, and it turned out they had none of these things. What had happened instead was that after basically 20 years of looking at this case and staging periodically heated up investigations, up higher up at the police department had simply said, look, if we haven't been able to flush out this man who's clearly a dangerous criminal, it's impossible that he would have stayed out of trouble for so long. How could such a person just go disappear into America and not get himself into a fix that would reveal him to be Frankie Kohler? So if he doesn't exist and his family keeps telling us they haven't heard from him, I don't know why you'd believe the family, but let's say he's dead. And that gives us closure on two homicide cases. And when Rosenzweig saw that, he really, I think that his initial impulse was quadrupled or quintupled with just the sense of, you know, this is the system I serve, the law enforcement system that I serve, but I really hate it when it gets sloppy like this, and it's just not right. I want to know if this guy is dead or alive. And even if all I do is prove that he's dead, that's worth something. But boy, if he's alive, I want to find him.
Yeah. He suspected that, in fact, Kohler was not dead, and that he started, as he, again, started to dig into it, came up with some reasons to think that, in fact, he had not vanished, and that for some time after the murders occurred, that he continued to live and work in the New York, New Jersey area.
Yeah, when you dig into a case file, the way that it works is that every time a detective goes out on a call of any kind or makes any kind of an inquiry or comes across any information, they fill out a form and they put it in the file and they stack these things up in a sort of file binder so that you're reading them in reverse chronological order with the latest news first. And as you flip back through a case file like that, there are all sorts of leads and threads and tips. And, of course, some of them are false leads and some of them are bum information and some of them are probably even deliberate misinformation by people on the street. But Rosenzweig's attitude was, we've got to follow up on all of these, and some of that led to, you know, him committing some pretty serious mistakes and blunders and going down some dead ends himself.
Yeah, well, he became convinced that Kohler was still living in the area and using the alias Frank Fitzgerald, and he apparently became so convinced that Frank Fitzgerald was in fact Frank Kohler that he got some men together and went to Mr. Fitzgerald's house to arrest him. And after having sitting down and talking with the guy for a little while, he became convinced that, in fact, no, he had made a mistake and that at that point, he had the wrong guy.
Yeah, this was one of the things that really drew me to this story when I first started talking to Andy Rosenzweig a few years ago and talking to him about his life as an investigator and realizing how unglamorous so much of it is and how a really successful case is usually built out of an enormous amount of tedious, frustrating, often misleading or mistaken leads, wandering off in every direction, just so that when you go to bed at night, you don't think, well, maybe if I'd looked that way, it would have been helpful, because you have looked that way. So you look at everything. You try everything. You turn it over. You're relentless. And I was fascinated by the way that an entire career of work as a cop and an investigator really had come to focus on this case where somebody had vanished without a trace, and that it in some ways, ultimately, he got his man. I think that's implicit from the fact that I was even writing about it. But the suspense was in the problem of even looking for him and the tedium of it, and where the temptation to hang it up the way the police department had hung it up and just said, let's call the guy dead.
Yeah.
Of course, it's the best thing a fugitive could ever hope for.
Well, and he and clearly other people were bothered by this case, because one of the things that Andy Rosenzweig did was that he looked up the detective who had originally been on this case, a guy named Tom Hallinan. And when Rosenzweig called and said he wanted to talk about an old case, immediately Hallinan knew which case it was, because it was the only thing that he'd been on that never got solved. And all those years later, it bugged him, too.
That's right. And that's part of what makes that's a very interesting point, which is Tom Hallinan, who had been the detective who had literally walked through the door on the night of the murders when, as he put it, he said it reminded him of the police firing range because the smell of gun smoke was still so heavy in the air. And Tom Hallinan was a great detective. He had an almost impeccable record throughout his career. And really, this, he was, says, was the only case he had not solved in a career that spanned more than 20 years as a detective in the New York PD. And it had bothered him, and it had remained with him. And I think part of what's interesting is how it would be sort of simpler or easier to say, well, this case went cold and this guy never got found before, because there were shoddy detectives who did sort of slack jobs and ultimately just didn't pursue it. But Tom Hallinan is not at all that kind of guy. And he'd had some adventures, just like Andy Rosenzweig did. He went off on some false leads and misdirections, the way that Frank Fitzgerald had caught Rosenzweig's eye. A man in Queens had once caught Tom Hallinan's eye, and when Tom Hallinan arrested him, he realized it wasn't Frankie Kohler, but he actually did realize he'd also caught a hitman for a drug cartel, and who was a very much wanted man. So mistakes can also be fruitful.
Yeah. Well, one thing that Hallinan told Rosenzweig that turned out to be very prescient, and we'll, you know, maybe as we continue to follow the story along, people will realize why. But what he said, Hallinan said to Rosenzweig, said, look, what you need to make sure you tell anybody who goes after this guy, that when you find him, he's going to be armed, and that he's a dangerous man, and don't forget that.
He said, when I talked to Tom Hallinan and he told me about that moment, his voice got sort of a little haunted. He said, whoever gets him, he's going to be armed. Please tell all your men. He really was convinced of this. And this was very much the reputation that Kohler had, and as we realized with time, had cultivated. He wanted to be thought of as a man of tremendous menace and a man who could be counted on to imperil your life.
I think certainly what makes the story compelling, not only is it a great story the way that unfolds, but what makes it compelling and interesting is the characters of these two men, Frank Kohler and Andy Rosenzweig. You talked a little bit about Rosenzweig, and we mentioned the fact that he had been a New York City police officer and had the reputation for being someone who was very dedicated, very conscientious, hardworking, serious, and very honest, about the straightest arrow kind of guy you could hardly that you could think of. And maybe tell us a little bit more about him and the kind of person he was that helps understand why it is that he would decide, as we said, you know, sort of close to retirement, to pick up this case that so many other people had just decided that it could sleep.
Well, in many ways, when you ask Rosenzweig, well, why'd you pick this up? He says, well, I always wonder that myself, why. But in some ways, he picked it up because he felt it was the right thing to do. It was that simple. Instead of sitting around and thinking, well, I could neglect this like everybody else, he thought, this can't be neglected. I've got to do something about this. And one of the lines that he liked to quote is a line that was once said to him by a homicide detective who had worked with him at the DA's office, who said, who speaks for the dead? Nobody. Unless we do, most of the time nobody does. And by we, he meant cops and investigators, and he really meant people have been killed, their lives have been taken, somebody's gotten away with murder. This is not a high-profile case. There isn't pressure from public interest groups or powerful families or moneyed interests. This is a case where what matters is that a known killer is at large, and two men have died in cold blood in this fashion. And I think to Rosenzweig, he just felt, you know, I don't want to live with that. And interestingly, he was very obsessed or influenced early on in life by the movie High Noon, a remarkable, great movie, which stars Gary Cooper as a sheriff in a small western town, who finds himself on the day of his wedding and at the moment of his retirement, in fact, confronted by the return to town of a bad gang who are about to menace the town. And he tries to raise a posse, and nobody in the town wants anything to do with it. They all want to accommodate. They all want to hide. They all want to lay low. They all want not to get into a quarrel. And he ends up taking this stand to defend this town that even by then he's given up on. He's almost disgusted by. And I think to Rosenzweig, it's that Gary Cooper line where he says, why do I do it? I've got to. That's all there is to it. I think for Andy Rosenzweig, there was also that same feeling. If you compromise and if you cut corners, it's this whole slippery slope, and then you've just got disorder. And what we're here to do, I mean, in some ways it makes him tough. It makes him humorless. As I say, it's quite unglamorous. He's a gruff guy. But he's determined. And he feels like, look, we can't take the attitude that these criminals are stupid or easy to catch. They're canny. We've got to be a lot cannier.
Yeah. Well, I think he's appealing precisely because he almost seems to be a character out of a novel. I mean, you can almost, maybe he's not quite colorful enough for Elmore Leonard, but, you can sort of almost imagine him in a noirish kind of detective story.
Yeah, well, I think that he came from the streets of the Bronx, is where he got his education. He was a patrolman. As a young cop, he was formed in the 4-1 precinct, which was then Fort Apache, in the late 60s in the Bronx, as a foot patrolman. Look, to get a sense of who Andy Rosenzweig is, he's a man who in the late 60s, early 70s, when they started to introduce air conditioning into patrol cars in New York City, he opposed it. He opposed it because, he said, it insulates us too much from the streets, because then we roll up our windows and we're only on radios and we don't hear and listen to literally what's wafting in the windows. Sure, it's more comfortable. Sure, life's better. Sure, you don't feel like taking a nap as often. But it's not, we're not in contact. It's one more thing that removes us from the actual intimate reality of policing that he'd grown up with. That's very much where he comes from.
Well, again, we're getting closer to our midpoint. I should mention that our guest is Philip Gourevitch. He's a staff writer from the New Yorker magazine. His new book is A Cold Case, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. The story of this is how a 27-year-old murder was solved. He wrote about it for the magazine, and this is an expanded version of that story. His first book, We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, Stories from Rwanda, was published in 1998 and won the National Book Critics Circle Award. And questions certainly are welcome, or you can just sit back and listen to the story. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, what Rosenzweig did, he tried to pursue some of the angles that the detectives at the time of the murder had done, and that was to talk with and try to keep an eye on Frank Kohler's family members, thinking that maybe somehow that would provide a link to his whereabouts. For example, they watched his brother, thinking that, well, maybe Frankie might just come for a visit one day and they would get him that way. That didn't pan out, but then they started getting interested in the fact that he had some relatives living in California, and they thought, well, maybe again, that might be some way to get a line on Frank's whereabouts, and this turned out to be successful.
Yes, well, what happened was that they really felt that they'd scratched all the way to the bottom of the barrel and were feeling pretty frustrated with working their way through all of the connections they could find in New York. And, of course, you have to remember this was a case where one of the few advantages that you have in a case this old is the idea that the suspect and those around him might think that you're not paying attention anymore. Mm-hmm. They have reason to know that they haven't heard from the cops in a long time. And so you have to also proceed with great caution not to tip anybody off that you're looking into this. So you have to do it from a distance. It's about Rosenzweig often described it as sort of concentric circles, but staying always on the periphery, looking in, looking at phone records, trying to find out where this guy is. They turned to California almost out of frustration, and there were a couple of nephews out there named McMullen, two McMullen brothers living in a town called Benicia, California, in the East Bay, and they were both career criminals who'd been arrested dozens of times each. And they thought, well, look, let's look at one of these guys who's in jail. Maybe we can tap his jail phone calls. So they had a jailhouse investigator in California look into him. And they couldn't get anything definitive, but they got the feeling that there was reference to a Frankie, an uncle, somebody in the orbit who might fit the description of Kohler, or might in some way be the influence. And they did, and Rosenzweig decided to send two of his men out, and he picked as the date, he picked Frankie Kohler's birthday, thinking if there's any time that the family might move around in such a way that would lead us to him, it might be on Frankie Kohler's birthday. He sent these two young men out, these two young investigators who hooked up with an FBI agent out there, and they started knocking on doors and ultimately got the hunch that maybe the man they were looking for was going by an alias called Frank O'Grady. And, well, not to give too much away, but when they looked into that a little more, they became almost 100% convinced that that was the case. And they also realized that in the process they had, in fact, blown their cover, and that this man named Frank O'Grady, who was probably Frankie Kohler, was now once again on the run and not coming home to Benicia.
Yeah, well, we won't give the punchline on that. It's too good. We'll save that for people who read the book. But what happened was, obviously, yeah, the family understood full well what was going on, who these people were, that they were after Frank, and they tipped him. And then the investigators, once they knew, okay, our cover's blown, then they just went flat out and just started talking to people, anybody, asking everybody, you know, what's the deal on this guy? What do you know about him? And that's when they found out that Frank had decided to go back to New York, that he got on a train, and they actually knew what train it was and knew what time he would be arriving in Penn Station. So they went down to meet the train.
Yes, they did. I mean, it was still, there wasn't 100% certainty that it was him, but it was like 99%. They were told that they expected that he was on a train that was coming into Penn Station. Rosenzweig had about 15 minutes warning about this, because that's how the investigation was paced out in California, that it caught up. He raced down there with some of his men. And the key thing here is nobody had any image of Frankie Kohler. None of these men had ever seen Frankie Kohler in their lives. And all they had, the latest picture they had of him was a 1962, 35-year-old, in other words, in 1997, a 1962 parole photograph from when he was released from Greenhaven Prison on an armed robbery bid that he had been serving there. And you don't know what 35 years is going to do to a face. And so they really weren't sure what they were looking for exactly. They had their hunches. They had these images memorized. And then suddenly train doors open, and a flood of people moves onto a couple of escalators and off into New York City. And this was their chance to try and grab their man.
Yeah.
Ultimately, again, one of Rosenzweig's investigators had a hunch, and that hunch turned out to be correct. And Frankie Kohler was once again a prisoner.
Yeah, it sounds as if that was there was some luck involved here, because he could very well have slipped by them.
Yeah, bad luck for him, good luck for the investigators, and a very shrewd eye on the part of the investigator Tommy Pahn, who read some physical characteristics about him, but also some of the ways that he was behaving. One of the things that struck him was that this slightly suspicious-looking older guy, who in some ways he thought fit his picture of Kohler as Kohler might have aged, was behaving differently. While all the other passengers rode up on the escalator, you know, looking straight ahead with their bag by their side, fixed on getting somewhere, this man kept looking around, kept eyeballing everybody, and was looking around in a way that, you know, that also rang a bell for Tommy Pahn, the investigator. And he said, you know, there's something about this guy. And when their eyes locked, there was a sense of mutual recognition. You're the guy I'm looking for. You're the guy who's looking for me.
Yeah. And going back to what Tom Hallinan had told Andy Rosenzweig, it turned out in fact that Frankie Kohler, he was carrying a gun.
He certainly was carrying a gun. He wasn't carrying it in his pocket. He had put it in his suitcase before he got off the train, but he had come into town carrying a loaded .380 pistol loaded up with dum-dum bullets, and he had a kind of fantasy in his mind throughout much of the train ride, it turned out, of shooting it out with whoever came to get him, if anybody did come to get him, going out in a hail of bullets. He claims that in the course of the train ride, as he puts it, I got a little religion by talking to people on the train and watching them and thinking, geez, I don't want to go out with other people getting hurt. And in a way, he then fantasized that he had He'd given himself up. He had surrendered. He had chosen not to. He had chosen not to put up a fight, and in some ways, he felt he ought to be rewarded for his reformed behavior.
Yeah. Andy Rosenzweig wasn't, he was somewhere place else at the time, and he was sitting there and he'd watched the people come off the train and eventually trickle out and had heard nothing. And he was thinking, well, either they were wrong or they'd got by him when one of the guys came in to him and said, "We got him." And so they took him into the room where Frank Kohler was sitting there. And Andy Rosenzweig came into the room, and it says in the text in the book that nobody had mentioned this name. You know, nobody had said Frank Kohler. So it was Andy Rosenzweig who looked at this guy, and he was the one who was able to say, "You're Frank Kohler." It must have been quite a moment for him.
I think it was for both of them.
For both guys, yeah.
But for Andy Rosenzweig, yes, it was this sense that a case that had spanned really all of his life, that when he was a young man, he'd been friends with one of the victims. And throughout his career, he had been sort of vaguely aware in a periodic way that the killer had never been caught. And here was this, here, by sheer dint of unexpected detective work, he'd flushed this guy out, and not only flushed him out, but flushed him into his own arms in New York. And to see him there and to think, you know, we got the guy. We got him. Here he is. I think he was very excited and moved. And of course, there's no room for all of that at the moment. What you have to think about is, okay, now how are we going to figure out what kind of a guy he is? Is he going to cooperate with us? Will he acknowledge who he is and what he's done? And that became the next step, which was the phase of a kind of interrogation, which led to Frankie Kohler delivering a pretty remarkable confession on video.
Yeah, because they knew that it was an old case. At this point, they only now had one living witness. The girlfriend of one of the guys.
He was the only sort of direct substantial witness, probably.
And so they knew that it would be if it had to go to trial, and if he had a good lawyer and he pleaded not guilty, that this might have been difficult for them to get a conviction. So what they were hoping was that they wouldn't have to go through that.
I think that's right. I think that it immediately makes for a very tough case, and that's so. There's a kind of there's a kind of suspense that immediately arises from the fact that the guy's caught, and yet he could still walk. That's how our legal system works.
What you had been able to do then, kind of after they had the guy, you had a chance, Frank Kohler, you had a chance to talk with him. You went and you talked with both his wife and ex-wife to try to get some kind of picture of who this guy was. And that's another part of this that I think makes the whole story compelling, is getting some insight into this guy's character and how it is that he became the person that he was. What sort of things do you think you learned about Frank Kohler that would help provide some answer to that question?
Well, I think Frank Kohler was a person who thought of himself, you know, as a murderer. There are people who kill here and there and who say, "Oh, I'm really a nice guy and I never would do such a thing." And there are people who kill in the heat of passion or so. He's a man who thought of himself as a criminal, who figured himself from an early age as a student of other criminals. He wanted to be in the crowd with the bigger guys in the New York rackets, and he cultivated an idea of himself as a dangerous and menacing guy, and a guy who's very at home with himself as a taker of life. And that makes him interesting because he doesn't, on the other hand, he's a man of some charm and of, and not surprisingly, as is often the case with violent or cruel people, there's also a side of him that can be quite amiable, warm, loving, nostalgic, even a little bit of a softy on the surface. And this was the side that he exhibited primarily to the people he lived with out in Benicia, California during those 20-plus years that he lived there as a fugitive. He was a beloved figure in that town. He never had a driver's license. He walked everywhere. That was part of his not wanting to identify himself to the world. And it's a small town. He walked up and down the main street, First Street. He would hang out at the coffee shops. They called him the mayor of downtown in New York, Frankie, because, you know, he would do kindnesses he'd help old ladies across the street. He was like a Boy Scout, the stories they tell. And sometimes they tell these stories out there as if this exonerated him. They'd say, you know, he couldn't have been such a bad guy, or he must have reformed, as if it was impossible that these two seemingly contradictory sides the benign old geezer around the community and the ruthless, bloody murderer could inhabit the same skin. And, you know, it actually, I've been reminded recently by this case out of Philadelphia of the guy that's always called the hippie fugitive, the murderer Einhorn.
Oh, yeah, right.
Who was just arrested in France for murdering his girlfriend and stuffing her in a trunk in 1969. And he was a successful fugitive for all these years. And they find him in this little town in Bordeaux and want to extradite him to the United States. Finally, they are extraditing him. And he'd skipped out during trial. And everybody in the town says, well, we'd be happy to keep him here because we just don't believe that he could be a murderer. He's just such a nice neighbor. And as if that somehow exonerated him or as if it was up to individuals to go ahead and say, well, if I don't kill again, I guess it's okay that I killed once.
Well, it does. This provide sort of an interesting answer to that question that everybody, even going back to the investigation, original investigation, sort of in the years around the murder, this question, well, how does somebody just disappear, particularly somebody who was like this, who had been in trouble all of his life, and everybody expected that sooner or later he would do something that would bring him to the attention of the police, that apparently then he actually did. He was successful in staying out of trouble. He left the area. He went to a small town. He never had a full-time job. He didn't have a social security number. He didn't have a driver's license. He laid low, and he behaved himself, and that's, I guess, the answer to the question, how is it that a wanted man just seems to disappear?
And he stayed out of touch with the people who might be the links to him.
Yeah. Well, did his the family that he had back in New York, did they know where he was?
My guess is that they probably did, some of them. I have the feeling that a lot of people ultimately knew. In one way or another where he was or pieces of it or that there were ways that the trail could have been. But as the FBI guy put it, they held their mud. And they say whether, and he put it very astutely, he said whether this was because they feared him or because they loved him or a little bit of both, who knows. But people did not give up or rat out because you've got to figure that Frankie Kohler, he stayed connected. He made it very clear that he stayed connected to some of his underworld connections in New York. Some of those people would have gotten in trouble over the years. When people get in trouble, the police say, what else have you got? How could you help us out? How could you help yourself out by helping us out? A prisoner in that circumstance might say, you know, there's this old bum Frankie Kohler living out in California who's wanted for a double homicide. I'll trade you that for my freedom. Nobody ever ratted him out. So probably not that many people knew exactly where he was, and those who did held their mud. It was interesting when I met him in prison. I said, "So what'd you do? You know, how did you become such a good fugitive?" He said, "You want to know how to go on the lam?" It was as if I was, raised my hand in a class. I said, "Sure, tell me how to go on the lam." He said, "You stay indoors. You don't go out." And he had friends, as he puts it, who helped him immediately after the murders. He went to Boston, and from there they flew him off to Washington State. And in Washington State, he was put in they took him to a safe house in a little town where he basically stayed indoors for 6, 7, 8 months. He would go out at night. He said, you know, I would go out at night, get a little air, go back inside, stay in the house. That's how. And then he went to San Francisco where he had some family connections, but he kept a pretty strong distance from them and wound up in this town, Benicia, which had the advantage, especially 20 years ago, it was really off the beaten path. And he had the good fortune not to get into trouble again.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. We're talking with Philip Gurevich. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. The story we tell and more is in his new book, A Cold Case. So you might want to take a look at it. Questions are also welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Once they had him at the end of the story, and he told the story of these murders, clearly he, even 27 years later, there was no remorse about having killed these two guys. He talked about how he had done it. And one of the things that sort of intrigues me is, given that fact, why it is that when he was seen by the girlfriend and he knew that she could identify him to the police, he didn't shoot her too.
Well, that's a bit of a mystery. He says in his confession video, he says, what am I going to do, whack her? I'm not going to whack her. I'm not mad at her. And that's often his line. I don't kill for nothing. which is actually not quite true. He kills for very small reasons, but mostly his reasons are that he's enraged, he's upset, he feels slighted, he feels insulted, he wants somebody dead. And that's what he says very clearly. I wanted these guys dead, that's why they are dead. With the girlfriend, he claims, you know, I wasn't mad at her, I told her to shut up, and I got out of there. It may also be that he actually ran out of bullets by then that night, though there's no way of knowing, because the gun was never recovered. But it's there's something about Frank Kohler that just I found to be very much of a fascination, which has to do, it was something that I saw also in Killers in Rwanda, which is a kind of deep self-deception. There is the idea in him that he lives by a gangster's code, that he kills for honor or he kills for reasons of self-defense or to defend those around him. In fact, he always kills out of rage, an infuriated and sort of passionate sense of insult, which isn't really have anything to do with honor. And yet he also imagines, at times he talks about people who he says, you know, I could have killed them and I didn't. And he almost feels that he should get credit for this. He has a godlike sense of his own power to not just take life, but to spare it, as if we were all walking around these days because Frankie Kohler had chosen to let us live out of the bigness of his heart. And it really does, in some way, tell you something about the mind of a murderer of this sort. When you think, well, you know what, I don't go around killing people either. And at the same time, I don't really think that I should get a lot of credit for not killing people.
Yeah, that was the story he told when they caught him, and he had the gun. And he said, well, you know, at one point I was thinking that maybe what I would do is just take a few of you guys out and then shoot myself. And then I sort of thought, no, I'm not going to do that. Maybe these guys have families. And it was that same sort of thing that he initially thought, well, I'm going to kill some people. And then he decided, out of the goodness of his heart, not to, and then expected a pat on the back for having made that decision.
Yeah, at one point the interrogator says to him, good thing nothing went down at Penn Station today, referring to him getting off the train with a loaded gun, and he says, my choice, okay? The language that he speaks, and, you know, he was a man obsessed with Jimmy Cagney, even to this day. He looks back on the characters of the gangsters that Jimmy Cagney played in those movies from the 40s and 50s, this kind of strutting, smart-mouthed, never-go-yellow guy, as his model, and he talks like him. He has the same rhythms of speech. He comes from Hell's Kitchen. He speaks a kind of New York speech that at this point seems almost archaic and caricaturish because nobody talks like that no more. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He talks like that, exactly. It's
yeah.
Kind of unbelievable, and all of his gestures with his fingers pointed together, they go like that. And some of the music of that speech and the idiom of that speech, which came from him and it also came from the policemen of his generation and from investigators, Rosenzweig talked a little differently. He had a more refined and precise speech, but also very New York. Tom Hallinan had a kind of Irish New York. The music and rhythms of that were the music and rhythms of this story that were just a pleasure to write with because they conveyed so vividly, not just in their words, but in the flavor of the words and the flavor of the world that they came from, the mindset that had formed these men.
Yeah. You talked about when we talked about the fact that there probably were some people who knew where he was, but that nobody said anything, perhaps because they knew that Frankie continued to be well-connected and that there could be lethal consequences of saying anything. Those connections also were manifest again when it came time to him having representation. He ended up being represented by one of New York City's most expensive criminal lawyers.
Yeah, Murray Richman. Don't worry, Murray, he's known, because he's pretty good at getting people off or getting them very heavily reduced sentences, regardless of their guilt or innocence. And he's up in the Bronx. He's a lawyer who has represented a whole lot of mob guys. And when I asked him, how did Frank Kohler, a relatively penniless, relative non-entity in crime at this point, wind up in your hands? He said, oh, a mutual friend of ours, a great old friend of mine, a mob guy, sent him over here and said, you know, when Kohler got to New York and got in trouble, he contacted this mutual friend, also a guy who had been in jail for murder, which is where Kohler had met him as a young man, and he put him in touch with me. And Murray Richman is himself an incredible, colorful, bizarre character and a sort of, you know, a true American original.
We talked about the difficulties of the case, of the prosecutors knowing that they might have a hard time making the case and getting a conviction. So in part because of that, the prosecution, the defense made an agreement, and Frank was convicted on or pled guilty to the two murders and also a gun charge. And basically he got, 6 to 12, so that would mean he would be eligible first eligible for parole in about 2 years, 2003.
He would be eligible for parole in about 2 years, which is an extremely reduced sentence. I mean, the families of the victims who were there at the trial and spoke passionately and eloquently about the agony of this case for them made it very clear that this was just, to them, an outrageous sentence. On the other hand, if Frankie Kohler had been caught and convicted at the time of the murders, he would have been in jail until now, almost certainly anyway. Instead, he managed, by being a successful fugitive, to have 27 years free. He complained when I visited him in prison, oh, they make it sound like a light sentence, 6.5 to 13. It's a death sentence. I'm 70 years old, which he now is 71, I guess, or 72. And he... So he's like, I'll die in jail for sure. My health is terrible. He's a bit of a hypochondriac, and he exaggerates. He's not in great health, but he was prone to looking for self-pity wherever he could find it. My feeling was he did very well. My feeling is also that he's not necessarily a great candidate for parole, having gotten away for so long with it. And as he himself wrote in the letter to Murray Richmond after I interviewed him, he said, probably talking to that journalist bum didn't do me any good with the parole board.
So I understand that they're talking about making a movie out of this.
That's right. It was optioned by Universal Pictures for Tom Hanks, who was interested in playing Andy Rosenzweig. And a script is being written at this point, I believe, by John Sayles. And you never know about these things until you're watching them on the screen, whether they'll come to be. But I'm told it's very much in the works.
Yeah. Well, I think if you were going to have a movie made out of this, you could do a lot worse than have John Sayles be the director. And at least you'd get a movie that would be interesting and sort of off the beaten path.
Well, I was thrilled. I mean, I think that John Sayles has a real sense of New York too. I couldn't ask for sort of a more thoughtful and tasteful group of movie people to be doing it.
Yeah. So do you think chances are maybe Frank Kohler will die in jail?
Well, I mean, he's 72 years old and he's not in great health, and jail is not good for your health in general. He smokes like a chimney. He wants to, trying to smoke himself to death. He loves to talk about sort of being suicidal or, if only I could just take my own life or put an end to it. But I think he likes himself a bit too much for that. But he's not in great health, and he's 72. He could be there for as little as 2 more years, then he could see the streets again. It might be that he's there for another dozen years, in which case it's quite possible that he would leave to the graveyard.
Yeah. Well, it's a great story, and I really appreciate you taking some time to talk about it with us.
Well, thanks for taking the time with me. It's been a pleasure.
Our guest, Philip Gurevich, he is a staff writer of The New Yorker magazine, and if you'd like to read it, and there is indeed more to the story, you haven't heard it all, there's more to the story in the book, A Cold Case. It's just recently out. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux.